A t-shirt and jeans, mac and cheese. Some things in life are an obvious match, like RIAs and Schwab Advisor Services, the number one choice for independent advisors. The difference is so obvious, it's Schwabvious. Learn why at Schwabvious.com.
I always had a private doctor. I didn't think I needed VA care. Then I learned VA is ranked above private care systems nearby and costs less. I'm getting the best care of my life with providers trained to treat veterans. Get what you earn. Visit choose.va.gov.
Not all veterans are eligible for the type or amount of benefits mentioned here.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi, Stacey Cole, and Todd Michaels.
We love to tell ourselves that justice ends at the verdict. But in America, justice often just kind of changes platforms a little bit. Brian Koberger can't leave his cell, but his story sure can. And in Idaho, that's where there's no Son of Sam law. That story could make him money. Free speech is sacred, but freedom to profit from murder? That's not right. That's an oversight. Eric Faddis is joining us to discuss, former prosecutor and defense attorney. Eric, when you hear that convicted killer, Brian Koberger, could legally make money off of his story, off of his crimes, what's your first reaction as a prosecutor or just as a human being?
Yeah, Tony, I mean, when you go out and slaughter innocent people, you shouldn't be entitled to some kind of benefit for that, some kind of monetary windfall for those horrible misdeeds. And so that's my initial impression. I think that's how a lot of society sees it. You know, on the other hand, there are interests regarding free speech and that kind of thing. And so it's sort of a balance that the courts and legislators have to look into. And it looks like it wasn't adequately looked into, at least in Ohio.
And the thing is, with the Son of Sam laws, it's kind of a quilt of it across the United States. Every pattern, every square, a little bit different in terms of what it allows for and what it doesn't allow for. And some patches of that quilt are just blank. And that would be what Idaho is. There's nothing there. No thought put into it because there's never been legislation on the books for it. And where it is on the books, a lot of places has been watered down. It's been changed. It's been this. It's been that. Some have stronger ones, some have weaker ones. Idaho never passing one in general. I mean, walk us into what that means in plain terms. What's legally allowed and what shouldn't be in Idaho?
Yeah, you know, Tony, I mean, these laws have come about. The Son of Sam law came about in New York, where they had a mass killer, the Son of Sam. He wanted to profit off his crimes by writing a book, and they said, hey, no, you can't do that. You know, I'm not sure Idaho perhaps envisioned that they might have some mass killer who might want to do this there. Perhaps they should have, but they didn't. What it means, Tony, is that at least as the law stands right now, Koberger could write a book. He could write a tell-all. He could receive monies from that tell-all, and that could make his lifestyle better while in prison for the rest of his life, substantially better, potentially.
Can we talk about what that means? Sorry about that, Tony. Can we talk about what that would mean for his life in prison if he's got more money? How much of that would he even be able to use? Would it even be worth it to him?
Stacey, I think it would because, you know, there are a number of ways you can improve your situation while in prison. One is just through basic commissary. He would have the ability to kind of purchase the goods that he wanted, higher end food items. One thing that can do is that can be used as money in prison, and he can make trades. He can gain loyalty and power and influence potentially, and protection as well. On top of that, you know, he could send money to other inmates. I mean, just talking hypothetically, but possibly prison gangs to try to get protection therefrom, to try to get them to do things he wanted them to do. And so there is really a cascading effect of such an inmate receiving substantial funds, even though they are locked up.
So there's no limit on how much he can use per month, that kind of thing.
There may be institutional limits at different facilities. But that being said, if you're sitting on, you know, tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars or more, and you're going to be in there for the next 40 True. Plus years, that has a cumulative effect over time.
It's almost, I mean, I guess the way I would try to think about it would be almost like a video game. You're playing in the world of that prison, and there's certain limits as to what you can put into your container of goods of what you can add to it. And if you got, you know, enough points or whatever in the game, you can max that out. You can, True. You know, get everything you need, everything that you could possibly within the confines of the limit. So, you know, it's not like he's, you know, going to necessarily be buying a Rolls Royce and right. be, you know, going around the prison yard. But, you know, he could have, you know, whatever hot top, you know, top items there are in all of them, and use that as currency and use that as status and use that as comfort, I think, at the end of the day. I think that's the biggest thing that people are angry at, is the idea that he can still maintain some level of comfort behind bars. Let's speak to that a little bit, because there are, you know, there are limits, like you said, you know, in prison cells of what you can and can't have. I mean, what's been your experience when you've, you know, you've had clients or you've dealt with folks that have been behind bars? What has shocked you the most, you know, in your line of work, where what you see going on behind those bars in terms of creature comforts that maybe the outside world is not super aware of?
You know, within those prison walls, within jail walls and any sort of correctional institution, you know, you'd be surprised how valuable like a honey bun is, or how, mm-hmm. you know, these folks, there's a scarcity of, you know, sort of delightful food items. And you'd be surprised how far it can go and how much you can gain from having possession of these things, trading them for favors, for protection, for other comforts. And then you got to look to the outside. The walls of that correctional facility, there are transactions that are made all the time. There are agreements that are brokered within the facility such that, you know, a person who has funds might send some of those funds or direct them to be sent to an inmate's family outside, or an inmate's friends or gang members potentially, to pay their bonds, to pay for legal fees. There are all sorts of transactions that happen outside the prison walls as well that are contemplated by a prisoner who acquires substantial monies.
How is it that we have a state like this? Because it's not like Idaho is short on crime. I mean, Idaho has its fair share of crazy folks. I mean, people kind of go to that part of the country when they're not in the best of mindsets. Like, I'm going to go off here, be by myself, and then, well, shit ends up hitting the fan for many of them. Why do you think it is that that state just doesn't have any sort of law like that on the books? Is it ignorance? Is it politics? Is it fear of being called anti free speech? What's your conjecture on it, Eric?
You know, it's a bit puzzling, Tony, because we've had this issue arise decades and decades and decades ago. It came about with the Son of Sam issue, and that was in the 70s. You know, it's 2025 right now. You would expect that a legislature would say, hey, yeah, a criminal should not profit from the crimes that they did and get a ton of money from it. But perhaps there were other legislative priorities. Perhaps they didn't foresee that kind of thing happening in their state. You know, it's not Los Angeles, it's not New York, that kind of thing. But that doesn't excuse this kind of omission. It seems like it should be in place everywhere. And it's not. And now we have a criminal who might make a shit ton of money off of slaughtering these four innocent college students.
Well, it's a weird thing, because the argument, well, it's hampering free speech. I don't know that I agree with that, because if you were to have, and the states that do have these sort of things in place, it doesn't prevent someone from sharing their story. I mean, and the purpose of that would not be to prevent him if he wants to go do his tell-all, do your tell-all. You just can't make money on it, basically, is what it would state. But it also, here's, I guess, how it could hamper it, but then you have to go back to motivation of somebody trying to profit off of the murders by getting information directly from the killer. Because if you have a law like that in place, great, the killer can profit off of it. But you know who else can profit off of it? The people who are spending the time making it. So the creator, if you will, that wants to go in and do the tell-all story with Brian Koberger also couldn't take that information, couldn't take whatever they gleaned off of him, and then go and write the book and publish it, because and then profit from it, because that would have been directly from him, from what he has contractually agreed to give that creator. So that pretty much takes away the incentive, if you will, for any sort of creator, publisher, whatever, from wanting to go in and have that conversation, because it's not profitable. And at the end of the day, that's what drives all of it. People are going to want to make some money if they're going to put their time at it. So at the end, then nobody wants to tell the story because nobody's making money. But is that story worth being told at some point in time? I guess that is the conundrum and where the free speech argument comes in. What's your thoughts on that kind of vicious circle that creates?
Yeah, Tony, I hear you. And MNT7949, thanks for the shout out. Glad you're here. So when it comes to free speech stuff, I'm aligned with you that, hey, these people should be able to express themselves in terms of making statements about this matter of public concern, this crime that they committed. But that's where the line should be drawn, is the making money piece. You know, when you think about things like other expressive activity under the First Amendment, you know, you can make provocative, risque art, but you can't make child exploitative material and say, oh, well, you know, I was just it's just expressive. I'm just expressing my free speech. The law does draw lines there. Free speech is not absolute. And I think what the line that is being established, hopefully, is criminal profiteering. So, yeah, you can talk about your crimes, but you can't cash in on them after the fact. But there are, like you said, sort of workarounds where different producers and media teams can, in a roundabout way, try and profit from that. And, you know, who's to say that those profits would not go to Koberger's family, would not somehow through a convoluted a chain of transactions get back to him. There are a lot of issues that abound when we talk about these productions of art regarding these crimes.
Stacey, do you have a question?
I do. I want to know, can the families get out ahead of this? Can they file some sort of preemptive injunction before things happen, or do they have to wait? Almost like, you know, we'll put up the stop sign after a bunch of people die at the intersection, kind of a concept.
The thing is, Stacey, they would have to have a law on which they could hang their hat, on which their motion or request to the court or whomever would be based. And when you have in Idaho a lack of such a law, you know, they can't just go and say, hey, this would be terribly unfair. You guys shouldn't allow this. They kind of need a legal mechanism by which they could bring that to some kind of arbiter like a court. And no such legal mechanism appears to exist in Idaho. So the family do have other roundabout civil remedies that they could try to sort of obstruct Koberger's ability to get money from this. But in terms of a direct legal path to say, hey, stop this guy, I don't think they got it.
Damn it.
I mean, how has this worked in other states when they are realizing, oh, shit, this guy could start making some money on this? Obviously, if there is legislation in place, it's there. But, you know, is this something where they can get out ahead of it in other ways in terms of getting something in place? And if they were to, say, get some sort of legislation in place that says you can't profit from this, would it be applicable to only cases going forward after that? Or would it be applicable retroactively towards Koberger?
So that would depend in part on the nature of the legislation, the provisions therein. Legislators can put in provisions for retroactive application, and there are sometimes some legal challenges to such a provision. But even if it was only prospective prohibition of saying, hey, Kohlberg, you can't like write a book and make a bunch of money from it, if they were able to get that law in place before the book was published, that would still probably prevent any criminal profiteering from some subsequent piece of literature, if you want to call it that. Mm-hmm. So it is possible if the legislator acted quickly that they could try to improve this issue, but they haven't.
Is there an argument here there where it would discourage not want to say exploiting the case, but studying the case? Because I mean, it all comes down to how the case is being looked at. For example, Catherine Ramsland's book about BTK, that was a very clinical look at Dennis Rader. I don't know the monetary logistics of it all, but I don't believe he profited from it from any way, shape, or form. I'm going out on a limb and guessing she did, because, you know, she's a clinical psychologist, a forensic psychologist, and I'm not saying that's wrong that she did. She's doing this from a very clinical type place. She's not coming to it from a creator, a podcaster, a whatever, a News Nation, whatever it may be. It's a very different way, shape, or form. Should there be, and I guess, are there any provisions in the states that do have these sort of laws in place that recognize the difference between someone that's, you know, strictly for profit, we're creating entertainment, we're creating things for people to consume and making money off of it, versus I'm creating this, going to make some money off of it because my time is valuable, but I'm coming to it from a more clinical type standpoint.
You know, and that's exactly where the tension lies, Tony, because mm-hmm. on the flip side of this issue, we want public access to information. Mm-hmm. The entire world, including the victims' families, were dying to know sort of Kohlberger's motivation behind this,
yes.
The way he went about it, the details of it, whether he had anyone helping him. Mm-hmm. That's important to know, you know, just from a epistemological standpoint, but also from a preventative standpoint. Hey, how can we stop this in the future? What red flags can we jump on mm-hmm. that were elucidated during this during a piece that explores how this came about and who this criminal was. That's certainly important. And I think really that the line that's trying to be drawn is that criminal profiteering line where they're saying, hey, you can investigate, you can do a social sciences exploration of what happened here, but Kohlberger can't be receiving funds directly from it. Mm-hmm. But then there's always the potential workaround of him indirectly yeah. receiving some kind of benefit.
There's always going to be loopholes and stuff. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Stacey.
Yeah, thanks, Tony. I'm curious. I don't know a whole lot about our penal system, about what it's like to be incarcerated. Somebody like Kohlberger, where he just said, okay, I'm guilty, we're going to skip the trial, we're not going to see what I did, we're not going to see my motivation. Can they send somebody in to evaluate him and get these details? They've got some of them, obviously, but to actually release them as data for prevention, things like that, to maybe circumvent writing a book, that here is his case study. We went in, we figured out what was going on with him, and here are the facts.
Stacey, I'm not aware of any legal impediment to someone going in and trying to do that. Except that you have to have the declarant's cooperation. You have to have the criminal's
correct.
Cooperation. And so how do you get that? You know, is he going to do it out of the goodness of his heart?
But he likes the limelight, though. He likes the spotlight. He may like to be featured in some scientific article. So if you took it from that aspect, he might jump all over it.
All about the approach. How
correct.
You pitch it, basically. How you pitch it to him.
Completely true, because in part, as you know, Stacey, he was a PhD student. He at least
yes.
has some ostensible interest in the scientific studies. And so, yeah, perhaps you could persuade him to do it. But if he's like, I'll do it, I'll give you an interview for $5,000, that's right. going to be a non-starter.
And that's the thing. When there's, if you were to go into him and you were to pitch it as this is for science, this
right?
Is, it's like the Michael Scott check. I'm writing this out to science. It's maybe you could sway him, but if there's an option of, well, why would I give it to you when there's this other creator over here who's willing to give me all this and basically keep my canteen filled for life? Why would I give it to you when I could give it to them? At the end of the day, they don't care. The information is going to get out in some way, shape, or form. That's why it's important to have something in place. So there is less choice. If you want to tell your story, yeah, you can tell your story, but you're not going to only take the paying options here to do it. You've lost that ability when, you know, you were found guilty or you admitted guilt in this case. Why is it, do you think, Eric, that we don't have national laws on this? Why? I mean, is this something that needs to be state by state? Because we have obviously judicial systems that are based state by state. Obviously we have national charges too. We have federal charges or you have state charges. And then everybody's in on different types of charges. So would it be difficult to basically have a federal mandate that says, well, this is how this works, if they're in on a state charge like Koberger is?
I think it's a great question, because I also don't see any legal impediment to having a national law about it. And in fact, there's probably some political will on both sides behind that. You know, not a lot of people are going to object and say, no, I want this killer to make thousands of dollars. It seems like that would be a relatively easy thing to get the political will to support. And Ruth City makes a good point in the comments, too. She mentioned that Koberger didn't share his motive and he will use that for a cash grab later. That was my suspicion. Mm-hmm. When such provision was not included in the plea agreement, they could have said, hey, in order to get death penalty off the table, you got to tell us your motivation why you did this. They did not include that. And I was wondering if Koberger was keeping that close to the vest for a possible payout down the road.
Why do you think they did that from a legal standpoint? Why on earth do you think the DA, who I've called Santa Claus several times on this because he has the Santa Claus beard, why do you think they didn't put that in there? The families wanted it. I think the public wanted it. I think humanity wanted it. Was that, I mean, it's quite an oversight to say it's just an oversight, but why on earth do you think that they did not make him talk? If you want to take this plea, great, but you're going to talk like they did with Rader, like they've done with others. With him, it does feel like he got off way too easy without having to say anything. I don't know. Was it just the lack of motivation on the part of the DA or the prosecutor? I don't know. What's your take on that?
You know, it's hard to say. I can only speculate, but I'm wondering, you know, that's not a terribly common provision to be in plea agreements where the defendant has to give his reasons for what he did and talk about his motivation. However, it's not unprecedented. Like you said, it's happened before. They can build that into the plea agreement. I don't see any constitutional issue with that at all. And, you know, if you want the death penalty off the table, why don't you come and at least tell these families, give them some peace of mind as to what happened and why you did this. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if the prosecution was just sort of getting close to the trial, was going to be a huge nationally publicized thing, a lot of pressure, a lot of stress. And I'm wondering if they went to Koberger and said, hey, we want this provision in there. And he said, you know, I'll plead guilty to the four murders, but I'm not doing that provision. And they said, well, this is the best outcome we're going to get aside from going to trial. So we'll take it.
Yeah. I think they should have called his bluff on that. I mean, at the end of the day, I think will always, you know, I know it's bothered so many people. And I think is one of the biggest mistakes in the way that case was handled. The reality is with all this, even if there is a law that's in place, even if there is some motivation here, and hope to God there is, if there's any case that would drive some sort of legislation to be in place fairly quickly, I would think this might be the case for Idaho to get something on the books.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, even if that is on the books, it doesn't stop anyone from going, I'm going to go fill Koberger's canteen. And the reality is that is happening right as we speak. That's kind of what brought this conversation to light, is there's still a lot of pro-burgers out there. And I mean, there always has been these people. This goes back, you know, as long as someone's been incarcerated, there's been some whack jobs out there that want to get married to them and somehow think they're innocent and, you know, they exist. I mean, to me, it's like, see something, say something. Those are the unstable folks. Maybe we should lock up as well, because there's something wrong with you if this is what you're doing. But we don't live in that type of society. That would be the Tony land, which I don't think anybody wants to live in other than me. But the thing is, people can do that right now. There's nothing in place stopping that. Should there be something in place that stops the general public from having that ability to just on a whim go to the prison's website or however the hell they do it, and dropping money into the canteen of somebody that they feel sympathetic to? Or should that be limited to direct family or things of that nature? I'm not saying it has to be impossible for that to happen from the outside. They are human beings. There should be some level of this, of you know, where you could help someone that maybe be blood connected to you. But I don't know what that line is or where you would actually put that.
This is really a possibility, Tony. I didn't know this.
You can do it right now. That's what brought this conversation.
But I get that. But like, you and I could just go put money in his canteen.
Yes, we could. Do it for anybody. You could propose marriage to him right now, Stacey.
That will never happen.
I'm not saying you would, but I'm saying you could.
Are you sure?
Todd, you shut your hole. Your word hole needs to
how
be
many
quiet.
How much have you put in Luigi's canteen so far?
The guy works out. He's stacked.
Okay, back it up. Hit the button.
Yes.
Okay.
But I had no idea that the general... Thank you, Todd.
Yep.
The general public for any inmate could do that. I knew that people were giving money to Koberger, but I thought maybe that was just people who were in his family, that kind of thing. I didn't realize that it was general public that could go and say, you know what, I've got an extra $40 this month.
And unfortunately, that's what's happening right now with Brian Koberger.
And that's just sickening. How is that even possible? Again, like you said, Tony, these people are human. They do deserve basic things. But where are we drawing the line here, folks?
It's like the more infamous you are, the more you're going to get.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's definitely something that can be done right now. You know, Luigi Mangione is getting a ton of love while incarcerated pending his charges. And it'd be really a sticky situation to try and have a law that says, hey, you know, Joe Smith, who lives in Idaho, you can do pretty much whatever you want with your money, but you can't give it to this guy. Mm-hmm. And Joe Smith might say, hey, what the heck? You know, I see this differently. I think that the guy is innocent or whatever that they might think. And people are entitled to have, positions that are wrong and to take action on those positions. So I think the workability and the enforcement of such a law would be problematic. However, I think you could probably prohibit funding any sort of criminal profiteering, but then how do you distinguish, hey, no, I was just giving him money for the honey buns and not this, you know, to set up this future media piece he wants to do? That would be tough as well.
Well, I mean, and maybe that the policing of it is what it is. It is limited. There is only so much you can spend on your canteen on a weekly basis or day or whatever it is. Most prison systems do have that, where it's X amount. You can't like buy out the fucking canteen.
Right. He can't have like $100,000 sitting there.
And then become the canteen.
You know? Yeah.
I mean, because if you had that, then you know that you could do that. If you have endless funds, I'm gonna buy everything. And then you can jack up the price and then resell it from your cell or, you know, get shanked and have somebody steal it all from you. But I mean that's where the regulation does come into place, but then it does give them an endless supply of whatever they want, you know, within the means of that system. I don't know that there is a true mechanism that would truly stop this, because when you say, if you were to look at this case, Koberger, you go, yes, heartless, evil bastard, no food for you. But that's my opinion. That's pretty much, you know, I think society, healthy society as a whole's opinion. But how do you regulate it? How do you say, well, this guy is like this, but this guy who's also in here is like this, but if there's empathy over here for this person, maybe a lesser crime, how do you distinguish the two? You really can't, and say, well, because this person gets this, then you can't get this. It creates far more issues than it actually solves, I think, at the end of the day. And then we get lost in the minutia and the chaos. And maybe that's the answer. Maybe that's why Idaho hasn't done anything, because they're like, it's just more chaos. We're just going to limit you to like $40 a week and that's it. I don't know.
You know, if I may, there's one way that could help prevent Koberger from criminally profiteering from this. And it's sort of referenced in a comment from Shanna Edwards. So sorry for the loss of your niece, where she says the defendant was ordered to pay what he owed from his own funds in his commissary. And that is what could happen here. If the families sue Koberger for wrongful death and prevail, then they would have a judgment against him. And then any funds going to him could be subject to garnishment or complete depletion based on this outstanding amount that he owes. So even though you can't do it in a direct or it'd be hard to do it in a direct legislative way, you can do it in this roundabout civil remedy way. And I imagine the victim's families are thinking of doing just that.
Well, I mean, that's how it works right now with the judgments. And that's why Koberger is making that argument in court of, well, these families are made whole by GoFundMe, so I shouldn't have to pay anything in judgment. Right. Like, no, you should, because the way it's currently structured is 20% of whatever is in that account that you have is going directly back to the families to pay that restitution. Lori Vallow-Daybell trying to make the same argument, going, I'm in prison. I don't have any money. Well, guess what? Any money that does go into that account, 20% has to go back. And that's just how it's structured. One could argue, well, maybe it should be 100%, maybe it should be 80%, maybe it should be whatever. I feel like it should be a hell of a lot higher than 20%. But essentially, it's like wage garnishment at that point. Mm-hmm. And that's really what it is. But when you're behind bars for something like this, you know, naturally we want to see the person burn. And we want to have very, very little leeway, very little room for comforts. But again, that is how our system works. And that is why they are arguing, why am I paying these sort of, why should I have to pay? You're getting paid this or that. Because it's on you. Because someone paying your fees doesn't, you know, wipe your responsibility off of for it. But with that being said, again, there is this something that because every state, every system is so different, do we really need some sort of just national guideline, some sort of national law that says, here's how it works in this country? Would that fix a lot of these state-to-state issues?
I think totally. And when we're talking about, you know, what laws ought to be federal, what laws ought to be state by state, you know, if it's a matter of a local concern, you know, for example, when it comes to certain agricultural practices or certain mining practices, natural resource practices, that kind of thing. That's kind of a state-to-state thing. So, you know, some localities might say, hey, this industry helps our state and we want this kind of mining, whereas a second locale might say, hey, we don't want that. And that's a state-by-state issue. But here, there's no such matter of local concern that would dictate that such a prohibition should be state-by-state. It seems like criminal profiteering is wrong, you know, any which way you look at it, mm-hmm. no matter what state you're in, which would militate in favor of some sort of federal legislation.
Damn it.
So it's a messy one. It's because it's easy to go down the road of emotion on this, but then you got to look at the bigger picture. How would this, you know, you legislate, you can't just legislate for one inmate. And right. that's the reality of it. So does, you know, is it good for the greater good, or is this just legislating out of vindictiveness towards one person? Because that's never going to be an effective route of doing anything.
I also wonder how much Koberger, whether there's money involved or not, would just want to do this to get back at the families and feel some sort of control over the way this thing all laid out.
That's a great point.
I think that's what it's all about at the end. It's all about control. That's the one thing that feeds him. And this is the one little place he still has ability to have some control in, unless there is some action taken. So if anybody is angry about this right now and you are in Idaho, you got to call your legislators. Yeah. You got to let them know you want something to change, because they're not going to listen to people from outside of Idaho, number one. If you're in Idaho and you think this is crazy, then do something about it. Do something about it. Be on offense. Let's not be reactionary on this. Let's try and do something about it. You're not going to solve everything. In a roadblock is a roadblock. A speed bump is a speed bump. It's better than nothing. And it feels like there should be something there, because right now it's pretty much free game for Brian Koberger if he wants to make some money on this, which is pretty sick. But it is reality, and it's good with dealing with reality on reality's terms. Let's talk about another case. A six-year-old brought a gun to class. Four different adults sounded alarms. The assistant principal told them the kid's pockets were too small, couldn't possibly have a gun. Hours later, teacher Abby Zwerner was bleeding in the hallway floor. After four teachers said, I think this kid has a gun. The bullet came from a child's hand, six-year-old, and the failure from the adults who did not listen. Eric Faddis, defense attorney, former prosecutor with us to break this insanity down. Let's start with what made this case different. The shooter was a first grader. In your experience, how does a victim's attorney even build a negligence case when the perpetrator is too young to form criminal intent and the real blame actually sits on adults?
Yeah, that's the thing is many states have age floors such that if the wrongdoer, the tortfeasor or whatever, is under a certain age, you can't sue that person. And six, I've never heard of any state allowing suit of against a six-year-old. So you have to look at who else was responsible. What other parties might be culpable for this kind of an event? And so they looked towards the school administrator. My understanding is they actually tried to loop in the school board, who was ultimately, I think, dismissed from the civil case. So they're trying to get creative, and this is yet another bizarre wrinkle to the school shooting, you know, pandemic that we have in our country, and yet another problem that we have to try to solve as part of this larger problem.
This seems like a simple one. Don't be a dumbass. I mean, if somebody is telling you there is a child, they have a gun. We think they have a gun. Maybe they have a gun. We're not quite sure. There's something questionable that child has. But the school didn't act. And I also question this. And I'm not blaming the teachers who did what they were supposed to do. They had to go to the vice principal and say, okay, we think this. What on earth is going on in our country where if you're the teacher and you think the child has a gun, that you can't be the first one to go check out that bag? That somehow that child's rights supersede you going and saying, let me see your bag. This is where we live right now. Where a teacher is in fear of repercussions towards them for acting in a manner that could protect not only that child, but all the other kids around and themselves, because there could be repercussions. Well, you might be violating their rights. You might be doing this. You might be doing this. This is insane. I mean, it's adults running around in fear of the rights of a six-year-old who might have a fucking gun? I mean, what planet did this become normal on, and how the hell did we get here?
You know, there is sometimes a departure between constitutional jurisprudence and common sense, you know, because what we have here is, I think perhaps the concern by the teacher was that the child does have a Fourth Amendment right. It is less of a Fourth Amendment right against unreasonable searches and seizures than they would have outside of the school. They have less rights, but still some rights. And the school, if it's a public school, then they're state actors. And so they're kind of thinking to themselves, perhaps, hey, I don't want to violate this kid's Fourth Amendment rights and then be stuck with a lawsuit. But gosh, you got to weigh the potential evils here. And the other evil is that somebody gets shot in a school, which is happening with alarming frequency increasingly. So that there is sort of a tension between, hey, we want to make sure we're protecting rights. But then again, what about this common sense piece? What about this emerging problem in society? Should the Constitution and its jurisprudence kind of catch up to that? I think is a question a lot of people are asking.
If you go into a concert, if you go into any sort of busy place, they will check your bag. I can't go, you're violating my Fourth Amendment rights. You can't check my bag. You just have to trust me that everything's going to be A-OK. Why on earth? Why? How is this not applicable in a school setting?
So I think the distinction that the school would say exists is that, you know, at a concert, you're talking about private entities, private individuals, and you don't, no one has a Fourth Amendment right against private individuals trying to search your ship, but you do have a right against public entities trying to search your stuff. So in the school context, the Fourth Amendment applies, whereas at a private concert with private entities, it doesn't. I'm not saying that that's how it should be. I'm saying that that's how the current jurisprudence is laid out. And even though those students have a diminished right in against searches and seizures, there are still some rights there. But should we be empowering teachers to be able to take direct action on a serious lethal threat that could be imminent? I mean, I think the answer is of course. And so we've got to sort of make some legal changes to authorize that.
Well, and one of the things that they said, and I did some research on this, the district said that being shot isn't a normal teaching risk. I would like to argue that because
it isn't.
344 shootings since Columbine, that pushes that into the level of it is a risk. It's something that we've been seeing. It's a, I'm not going to call it a trend, but I'm going to say that, well, it's more than one. So it's a possibility. Yep, you're saying there's a chance. You're damn right there's a chance.
Yeah. No, Stacey, I'm totally with you because, and I think if you ask nearly any actual teacher, one of my best friends, Joey Cohen, is a teacher, and you better believe that that goes through his head.
Damn right.
Regularly. And so to say that this isn't sort of a normal work hazard of being a teacher, I think, is detached from the reality of this. I will call it an emerging trend in school shootings that we're seeing. Okay. And like the last 24 said, maybe in the 80s it might have been different, but 2025, this is the reality.
Well, how did we go from we're going to be really vigilant, we're going to keep all the kids safe, to, well, you all have these rights and we don't want to hurt your feelings? Or, I mean, it's insane. After Columbine, I was a senior when Columbine happened. I know you're a few years younger than me, Eric, but you would have been in school too when that was going on. Yeah. So you lived through being in the education system for many of the years after that. I got the fuck out, thank God. But it was disturbing. But we didn't care. Nobody thought, well, my rights are being violated. They're going to check my backpack. But they started checking everybody's backpack. You walked in the building, it was like walking into an airport for a little while where they're checking shit. And it was just the norm. Nobody was like, well, my rights are being violated. Did what the hell changed where this was just common sense where, yeah, we're going to make sure that this stuff is being checked so nobody gets hurt. No harm, no foul. But we're now at a place where we can't even look in a first grader's backpack to make sure there's nothing dangerous in there. I mean, that basically says right now, my daughter going off to school, all these kids come in with their backpacks. Teachers have no right to look in them no matter what, even when they suspect there might be something there that's dangerous because it might violate their Fourth Amendment right?
You know, I hear you, Tony, for sure. And the way that I would sort of suggest is the Fourth Amendment protects against, it doesn't protect against all searches and seizures, just seizures that are unreasonable.
Right.
And my God, isn't it reasonable if you've received warnings that this kid might have a firearm and there's all these school shootings happening to go in and search that kid's backpack? I think it's absolutely reasonable. And even if the school district has certain policies and procedures in place, there should be exceptions that allow them to deviate from those in the event of an emergent potential situation like this. So I don't think there would have been anything legally wrong with the teacher searching the bag. I understand they were trying to adhere to protocol, but sometimes you got to adhere to common sense.
Well, and this is a time where that actually failed. So if they were saying, well, we were trying to, you know, preserve the child's rights, well, you fucked up. I'm just going to say that. And this teacher is probably sitting there going, well, you know what? I give up. So at some point, we've got to come into the middle that, you know what? Tommy, we think has a gun. We're going to pull him out, take him to the counselor's office, not make a scene, not embarrass him, but we're going to check out this perceived threat and see what's going on. We need to get back to this point where we're protecting other people. I'm sorry. I'm just on a rant. I'm getting mad. Then
we sit and we wonder, well, why is it hard to get teachers? Why do we have bad teachers?
We're not protecting them.
And there's plenty of wonderful teachers, but when you create an environment for healthy, intelligent adults, that is going to be insanely risky, that is not going to work with them to help educate the children. It's going to work against them at every turn they take. You're going to end up with bottom of the barrel folks applying to be teachers. And
you're
the good ones
are safer of, work. Yeah. Tony, you're going to be safer working at a Starbucks drive-thru taking latte orders than teaching our next generation of kids.
And making more money. Yeah.
Correct.
And that's the sad reality of our education system. Again, something we do nothing to fix in this country, a glaring red problem. And we're just like, well, oh, those teachers. Like, no, that administration. Because 99% of these problems start with the administration operating out of fear of being sued. But maybe that's part of it, too. I mean, and there are plenty of times to sue a school district. There certainly are. But we also then get to the point where we're just solely operating on fear of lawsuits and not fear of children being killed.
Right.
And we're just not going to take the appropriate actions and hope that everything turns out good at the end of the day. And that seems to be how this went in this case.
Yeah, totally. And to Gen Z367's comment, you know, being a teacher is so difficult at this point. You know, they're constantly being scrutinized and ridiculed and condemned. And there are these parameters set on how they can even instruct their given discipline. You know, and on top of that, think about is to teach anybody anything. I'm trying to teach my brother how to change something on my car, and he's he's an adult with a master's degree. That's hard as heck. Think about teaching a bunch of teenagers ancient history or something. They have a hard enough job as it is, and now they have to deal with a lethal threat to their lives and perhaps being handcuffed in their ability to respond to it. Big problem.
They are. And that's the insanity of it. It is such a broken system. And that's why it's getting harder and harder to find good teachers out there. And the good ones have a lot of them have left. There's still several standing. But, you know, there's very few. I'm in my early 40s, and I can tell you, of all the people I knew from high school that, you know, went in, you know, just like this woman did here, you know, who went in and got shot, you go in rosy eyes, you know, wanting to do the right thing. Thank God we have people who are willing to be teachers and put up with children and have the patience to put up with these children and the horrible parents that are out there of these children and deal with those repercussions and still try to provide guidance. Thank God they exist. But at some point, there is a breaking point for every one of them. And I can say I'd probably 80 to 90% of the people I grew up with, again, I'm only in my early 40s, have left teaching because of shit like this, because the administrations are not using any sort of common sense, because it is so set up basically to operate out of fear and to not truly educate the kid and to make sure that they get certain scores in certain places so they get their funding. And I get it. You need your funding. But I mean, that there's so many things messed up. I could go on and on and on about how broken our system is, where, I mean, especially with funding, like, okay, well, you have the worst scores. Let's give you the least funding. Maybe that should be a sign they need more funding because they need help, not less help. But that's how our system works. The schools that have the best scores that end up having the best teachers because they have the best pay end up getting tons of resources and tons of money. And the schools that are struggling, it's like, oh, you're down. Let's keep kicking you. That's how the United States education system works. That's why we're in the problem we're in today. That's why we have the young adults that we have today. poor decision makers, because this is the system they came up in, the system that fostered it. This is not a broken system. This is how the system is designed to work right now. It's our job to say, this is broken. We need to change it. It is currently working as designed. And that, I think, is something nobody wants to accept, because it takes some courage. It takes work. It takes effort. It takes energy to change something as difficult as this whole thing is.
Yeah, most definitely. And I think, you know, funding is a huge issue. I think sometimes even political overreach in education on both sides can be a problem. I think some of those ideologies can sort of try to be infused into curriculums and into resources that students have and may no longer have. It can result in the students being less accommodated, having a slanted view on certain issues. And sometimes when there is not enough support for these students, especially those dealing with issues due to funding, due to politics, due to whatever reason, that contributes as well to the problem.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's an endless cycle, and it's like, okay, well, we fix this, but we got to fix, look at our conversation. It's like, yeah, well, if we did this, you still got this over here and this, and then it just becomes, you know, and at the end of the day, what do you do? And then, you know, and we're paying our teachers unbelievably low wages. I mean, shockingly low wages. I've seen some of the entry level salaries just around here. We're talking like 19,000 on some positions.
Again, Starbucks working the drive through. I'm not dissing Starbucks drive through.
That's like you make more panhandling outside of Starbucks, probably.
Yeah.
Honest to God. And then we want to entrust you with the well-being of our young people. And it's not to say that somebody, you know, very well intentioned, that money, I'll live in poverty because I believe in what I'm doing. Yeah, they will for so long. Mm-hmm. But then even, you know, you've been there a long time and you get up around the scale and you're still not high. You're still not in many
in
districts.
New people that are taking over the senior people's salary. Yeah. It's repulsive.
Broken. It is so broken. It is so repulsive. And again, everyone is living in fear in every school district. Every person who has a job, they are living in fear of doing it wrong. And then they end up making the wrong choices because of that fear that they're living in. I experienced it just the other week where I got a call from my school saying, hey, we found this out. Your daughter reported this. And just to let you know, we let these other parents know what she found out. And that's it. Like, you're a mandatory reporter. Correct me if I'm wrong. Yes, I am. So what does that mean? Well, it means we have to report and you're calling the parents? Yes, we're just going to do that.
That's not reporting.
I'm sorry. Let's back up for a moment here. Mandatory reporter. What does that actually mean? What does it mean? And are you going to call? Well, we normally, and yeah. So, I blame and I don't blame people for those sort of decisions, because there's a reason that there's a hesitancy to report certain things. Typically because something the administration said to them, because they don't want that bad mark on them. They don't want that bad PR. They don't want to be looked at as this. They don't want to be looked at as that. And that's how you get this fucking cycle that goes on forever. Look at the Devil's Den case. I mean, look at how they basically shuffle teachers around in so many districts like they do Catholic priests that molest kids. I mean, it's so freaking broken. It's insane. And it's an icky subject, so people don't like to talk about it either. But we did, and I'm glad we saved the world today. And,
I was going to say, did we fix anything?
No, but hopefully we opened up some people's eyes that didn't realize just how broken this shit show is. Eric Faddis, as always, thank you for coming on. Defense attorney, former prosecutor, Varner Faddis Law in Denver. Thank you so much for coming on, as always, Eric.
Great to be with you.
All right. Until next time, for Eric, Stacey, and Todd, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.